For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show we'll be out and about at both Wigtown and Boswell as we explore some of our book festival favourites. So, on today's show, I'll be chatting to Nigel Havers, to bomber pilot George Dunn, to historian Kate Williams, to former White House employee Eric Motley, to Bill Clegg, KC. But first, let's listen to how the Boswell Book Festival began.
I at last deliver to the world a work which I have long promised, and of which, I am afraid, too high expectations have been raised. The delay of its publication must be imputed, in a considerable degree, to the extraordinary zeal which has been shown by distinguished persons in all quarters to supply me with additional information concerning its illustrious subject, resembling in this the grateful tribes of ancient nations, of which every individual was eager to throw a stone upon the grave of a departed hero, and thus to share in the pious office of erecting an honourable monument to his memory.
James Boswell sprang from an ancient Ayrshire family which had been settled at Auchinleck since the 16th century. He was born in Edinburgh in 1740, where his father, who became Lord Auchinleck, was a judge in the Supreme Court of Scotland. His mother was descended from a minor branch of Scottish royalty. Now, from the start, Bozzy, as he was affectionately known, was drawn to the pleasure-loving side of life. His first visit to London at the age of 19 began a love affair with the city, which never wavered. But the ultimate prize for Boswell was his friendship with the towering figure of Dr. Samuel Johnson, compiler of the Definitive Dictionary of the English Language and celebrated man of letters. Boswell's friendship led him to become Johnson's biographer, and the account of his life has never been out of print. His life of Johnson established him as the inventor of modern biography and has upheld his reputation as one of the most innovative writers of the Enlightenment.
In reflecting that the illustrious subject of this work, by being more extensively and intimately known, however elevated before, has risen in the veneration and love of mankind, I feel a satisfaction beyond what fame can afford. We cannot indeed too much or too often admire his wonderful powers of mind, when we consider that the principal store of wit and wisdom which this work contains was not a particular selection from his general conversation, but was merely his occasional talk at such times as I had the good fortune to be in his company. And without doubt, if his discourse at other periods had been collected with the same attention, the whole tenor of what he uttered would have been found equally excellent.
More recently, Boswell's fame redoubled in the 20th century with the discovery and publication of his diaries, setting him alongside Pepys as one of the great diarists in the English language. Boswell ushered in the confessional memoir, which is so popular today. Nothing was omitted, including the innumerable sexual encounters, his battle with depression, his difficult relationship with his father, his frustrated political ambition, and his life as a lawyer in the Scottish courts. We'll find out more about the papers in a moment from George Turnbull and from Paul Tankard. But first, I asked Festival Director Caroline Knox how the Boswell Book Festival started.
It started because we have created a trust to promote the name of James Boswell, the great biographer who comes from Auchinleck in Ayrshire. And we realised quite early on that his work is no longer read. And we thought, how can we bring the attention back onto him? And as he was the founder of modern biography, the idea came that we should start a festival which was dedicated to telling people's life stories. So in other words, a festival of biography and memoir. We are the world's only festival of biography and memoir. And then the other thing we wanted to do was also bring a book festival into Ayrshire, because there's one in Glasgow and one in Wigtown, but nothing in this part of the world. And we wanted to actually help the regeneration of this bit of the southwest. We moved from James Boswell's own home, Auchinleck House, because it sounds really mundane, because we'd run out of car parking spaces. We loved it there, and authors who love Boswell loved it there. but as we grew, we just did not have the space, and people were having to park in mud, and, you know, it just became too uncomfortable for people to want to come. So that's when we were very lucky to be welcomed here by Prince Charles and his team. And this has allowed us to expand because we are using part of the estate as well. So our children's festival is down in the School of Engineering, and we have the Royal Drawing School here this year. So it's allowing us to expand and do different things.
Now, Boswell's book about Samuel Johnson is in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and the audio version comes in at 67 and a half hours.
Wow.
It's a bit of an epic work.
And I think that Boswell found in Johnson the father figure that he didn't have in his own father, with whom he was often in conflict. And, of course, Johnson was a great writer, more than just a great writer. And, of course, Boswell, that was what Boswell adored, and he loved mixing with people who were writers, artists. And so, in a way, the older man became the father figure that perhaps he might have chosen if he, you know, hadn't had his own father, Lord Auchinleck.
My vanity, or my kindness, makes me flatter myself that you would rather hear of me than of those whom I have mentioned. But of myself I have very little which I care to tell. Last winter I went down to my native town, where I found the streets much narrower and shorter than I thought I had left them, inhabited by a new race of people to whom I was very little known. My playfellows were grown old, and forced me to suspect that I was no longer young. My only remaining friend has changed his principles, and was become the tool of the predominant faction. My daughter-in-law, from whom I expected most, and whom I met with sincere benevolence, has lost the beauty and gaiety of youth, without having gained much of the wisdom of age.
Our theme allows us to program it, I think, in a more interesting way, because we are looking for people who have written, they're either great biographers, or we simply look at people who've written a book and who have an extraordinary life story to tell. I think it allows us a freedom. We don't have to go chasing the newest book all the time. We're chasing the most interesting life stories, and we try to get a real breadth, which is what, because Boswell in his own diaries, he's interested in everybody. And so we try to mimic this interest in everybody across our programme. And, I mean, it is indeed a challenge getting writers from London up here, because they have to give up a weekend to come to the festival.
I'm sure they don't mind.
But when they get here, of course, I think they love it, and they love the Ayrshire audience. The amount of writers who've said to me, our audience is particularly attentive and really warm and welcoming, I think they really appreciate that.
And a reply to Mr. Samuel Johnson from Norfolk Street, April the 23rd, 1755. Sir, the part of your dictionary which you have favoured me with the sight of has given me such an idea of the whole that I most sincerely congratulate the public upon the acquisition of a work long wanted and now executed with an industry, accuracy and judgment equal to the importance of the subject. You might perhaps have chosen one in which your genius would have appeared to more advantage, but you could not have fixed upon any other in which your labours would have done such substantial service to the present age and to posterity.
Another clip there of Jonathan Oliver reading The Life of Johnson by James Boswell. Now, Dr. Gordon Turnbull is head of the Great Boswell Editorial Project at Yale University. I asked him if Boswell was somewhat of a forgotten figure.
Not exactly forgotten. That is, in the world of higher literary study, Boswell is a household name. He authored the great Life of Johnson and published it in the year 1791. That is a book which not only immortalized the great Dr. Johnson himself, who would have been immortal anyway through his own wonderful works, it also immortalized Boswell. It had the curious effect, however, of placing him in Johnson's shadow. That is, he became known for about the 150 years after his death as Johnson's biographer. Then in the 20th century came the remarkable recovery of his private papers, many of which had been stashed away at his ancestral home, Auchinleck House, a couple of miles from where we are now. Others had made their way across the Irish Sea to his descendants in Ireland, called the Talbots of Malahide. Those papers were recovered after arduous and complicated effort, eventually sold to Yale University, which edits and publishes them. In the year 1950, there appeared the first volume of Boswell's private journal, the London Journal of 1762-63, and it rather astonished its academic editors by becoming a runaway worldwide bestseller. So Boswell has been known to literary history, but I would have to break that statement down into two parts. He became almost better known two centuries after his death than he was in his own immediate lifetime, and in some ways has been better known to literary history than he has been in the wonderful county of Ayrshire, the home of his ancestral estate, Auchinleck.
What sort of a job was that going through those papers?
In the original period, his descendants were fascinated by what they had, but were a little nervous about it. These days, in the 21st century, we take the idea of candid confessionality for granted. When I was confined at home by a ridiculous illness a few years ago, I inflicted upon myself 2 weeks of American daytime television and was shocked witless at what people admit to on national television. Boswell began to seem to me a paragon of reticence and self-concealment and pudicity. He's none of those things, but what it does show is how far ahead of the curve he was. His descendants in Scotland and then in Ireland didn't destroy the papers, although they did rip a few pages out, but they kept them, but were a bit understandably nervous about what we now know to be their very frank personal content. Boswell, well ahead of the post-Freudian era, the era of psychology and psychoanalysis and self-introspection, Boswell had a sense of writing as a therapy, as a way of assuaging the pain that we all will, as an inevitable feature of being alive, feel from time to time. And he knew the corollary of that, which was that people reading another person's account of distress and trying to battle through it would feel curiously and almost paradoxically comforted by that reading experience.
I think he was more important looking back than Johnson.
They were important in very different ways. Johnson will remain forever in the pantheon as a pioneering lexicographer. He was known for many years as Dictionary Johnson after his great and quirky but great Dictionary of the English Language came out in 1755. He was a brilliant moral essayist. His essays as The Rambler and The Idler stand up to reading now as burly, commonsensical, practical wisdom, lay sermons in a certain sense. His wry anti-novel, Rasselas, Prince of Abyssinia, will hold its own anywhere as a coming-of-age story, a quest for experience and knowledge that goes a bit funny at the end. It may even be that the young people know more than the elderly tutor Imlac actually does. They were different kinds of people. Boswell, now known as a pioneering figure in biography, but also a pioneering figure given his 20th century literary rebirth in the kind of candid confessional writing that Johnson himself would not have undertaken, being a very different personality.
Now, Johnson is famously, or perhaps as a joke, he's derisory to the Scots, and Boswell was a proper Ayrshireman. Did the two of them get on?
They got on famously. It's a complicated story, and I'm not even sure I, at this distance of time, can actually unravel how serious and how jokey Johnson was when he occasionally cracked his clever but sarcastic wit against the Scottish nation. We all know the famous dictionary definition of the word oats, a grain which in England is fed to horses, but which in Scotland supports the people. Boswell, who occasionally gave back as good as he got, was heard to remark, "Ah, sir, but what horses and what people?" To speak seriously for the moment, there were antagonisms between Scotland and England, even with the Union of the Crowns in 1603 and the Act of Union in 1707. English people like Johnson, who were alive at the time of the second Jacobite uprising, never really knew if there might be another one at some future point. There were political and doctrinal realities. Some of the witticisms, I do think, were just that, and a few of them were made playfully at his friend Boswell's expense. I'll say this about Boswell. He himself undertook the re-education of Dr. Johnson. Their famous tour to the Highlands and Hebrides in 1773 is one in which the older man was educated by the younger. Boswell tells us in his Journal of a Tour to the Hebrides that Johnson went home in great good humour, with his prejudices much lessened, and very grateful for the hospitality he'd been shown here, proving yet again that most things like national prejudices really are no more than a function of ignorance and occasionally arrogance.
Now, while Gordon Turnbull oversees Boswell's papers, Paul Tankard from the University of Otago in New Zealand has a different approach.
My collection is a collection of things that he did write for publication, but in ephemeral forms in newspapers and magazines. So he wrote 600 or so pieces for newspapers and magazines, and on the whole, they haven't seen the light of day since the 18th century. They get occasionally looked at by scholars who are wanting to fill in Boswell's biography, but no one's really looked at them in their own right as a body of material. And I was fascinated by the idea that there were these 600 things out there that had never been sifted through, gathered together. And so the challenge for me was to craft out of that a book that would represent Boswell as a journalist in all of his capacities. It could have been twice as long. There were other categories of material I could have included, his theatre reviews, his book reviews, and things about the law. He wrote about the law quite a bit, but instead I confined it to what I thought people would find most interesting: the life of Johnson, material about executions, actual reportage that he did, and a series of political, scurrilous political essays that he called The Rampager.
These were published anonymously, so did he keep copies of them, or did you have to go look for them following clues in his journal?
Last century, Frederick Pottle, who was in charge of the Boswell Editions office before Gordon Turnbull, he had done most of the bibliographical work on Boswell, and using Boswell's journals and also using Boswell's collections of clippings — Boswell kept everything, and as we heard before, the family kept everything as well — using those materials that only came to light in the early 20th century, it became possible to begin to identify the things that Boswell had written for newspapers.
We think fake news is something of today, but Boswell was quite a practitioner of fake news in his day.
In a sense, in the 18th century, most of the news was fake, or at least news that was true was the exception. Or we could put it another way and say that the things that were in newspapers, nobody expected them to be true. Some of them were, some of them weren't. What the newspapers recorded were things simply that were in circulation. And I don't think anybody had a real expectation that if you read it in the newspaper, it was necessarily true. It might have been, or it might not have been, and it didn't sort of matter a lot. I suppose if they were reporting the shipping news and court movements, things like that, they would have been accurate. But when it came to reporting other things like, you know, a certain literary gentleman was seen dining at the home of a certain Hibernian cleric visiting London, then people weren't identified. People who are in the know might have known what was being referred to. It might have been true, it might not have been. There are all sorts of other reasons for things being in the newspaper. And it was a completely different way of conceiving the newspaper, and it was more like the blogosphere of today. It was things that people wanted other people to think true or false.
Not much has changed.
Well, I think that, in fact, in the 20th century, when a lot of papers wanted to identify themselves as journals of record that could be relied upon to represent what had gone on a day-to-day basis, that's a bit of an anomaly, really, and that it's a sort of a 20th century invention. And in the 18th century, I think that newspaper readers would have read far more critically and cynically than we do, thinking to themselves, well, I wonder why this is in the newspaper, and I wonder who's contributed to it. And that was part of the story. Who might have put it in, who might have contributed it, what might their interest have been, and then to assess whether it might have been true and might have been false.
And Boswell used the newspapers to his own ends.
Oh, yes, yes. If he had a cause that he was involved in, he wouldn't hesitate to publicise it through the papers. At the end of his career, when he devoted himself mostly to writing the life of Samuel Johnson, for the 9 years that he was writing it, he would feed the newspapers things about Johnson and about himself and about the life of Johnson, about other biographers of Johnson, all of which he hoped would keep up interest. And none of these things would have his own name on them, or some of them. The occasional one would when he wanted to make an official pronouncement, but most of the time they wouldn't have his name on them. They were just little things that were intended to keep people thinking, oh, Samuel Johnson is still important, is still an issue, and Mr. Boswell is still working on his biography, and that's all interesting and exciting. And if he, a couple of times he was involved in legal cases that he wanted to sway public opinion, or at least he wanted people to be interested in the case, and he would again feed things to the newspapers about what was going on in the case, and not under his own name, of course, because that would have undermined it. So it was a way of affecting the climate of opinion and keeping something current.
Now, quick quiz, can you identify this TV theme tune? Did you get it? It's Perry Mason, cited by William Clegg QC as one of the reasons why he started a career in the law. Leading murder case lawyer Bill Clegg revisits his most intriguing trials, from the acquittal of Colin Stagg and the shooting of Jill Dando to some Nazi war crimes. And he himself narrates the audio version of Under the Wig.
How can I defend someone who I know is guilty? It's the question I am asked most often. It is really a velvet glove on some finger pointing. How can I, a decent man, speak up for a rapist or murderer? How can I put my professional skills and intellect at the disposal of someone who has committed such a terrible crime? All advocates are asked this question, perhaps me more than most, because of the nature of my career. I have defended more than 100 people accused of murder, probably more than any other lawyer practicing in England. The first thing to say is that in English law, to defend someone who I know in the strict sense of the word is guilty is not allowed. If the client tells me they are guilty, I must not tell a court they are innocent. For crimes such as fraud or drugs, a client may freely acknowledge what they have done and plead guilty. Perhaps after I have pointed out the strength of the case against them and told them of the reduced sentence that greets a guilty plea. This happens often. I don't varnish the facts. Murder, though, is different. Murder is killing someone with the intention of causing them serious harm or death, and a sentence of life imprisonment automatically follows for anyone who pleads guilty or is convicted by a jury. The most that is given is a minor reduction in the tariff, the minimum jail term that must be served before parole is considered, which is little incentive to admit guilt. So a client will not usually tell me they have committed murder.
The book is not designed to be a standard autobiography. Every alternate chapter explains to the layman what it's like to become a barrister, how we prepare cases, how we do our work and run our practices, how we become a QC, how we become a judge, and things like that. And the intervening chapters describe a case that I've been involved in.
Now, you've been in the job for 47 years. Have you seen many changes in the way of diversity in the workplace?
There's been a huge change in the workplace with diversity. When I started, there were comparatively few women judges, comparatively few women barristers. That has now changed, and all for the better. The majority of people coming into the profession now, in fact, are women, just over 50%, which is encouraging. And there's also been ethnic diversity as well. Chambers tend to be much more balanced between the sexes and between different racial backgrounds, which is all to the good.
I know you've had various different roles, but you say you're a natural defender. What makes you a natural defender?
I don't know. I think I'm better at being a defender than I am a prosecutor. I don't quite know why. I suppose it's a sort of vague feeling of sort of helping the underdog. And most of the television drama that first interested me in the law is based on defence lawyers. So that's probably where it comes from.
Yeah, you mentioned Perry Mason.
Yes, indeed. That was my introduction to the law. He never lost a case.
Now, the audio version of the book is read by yourself. How was that process?
I found it very interesting. It took two long days, and in a recording studio where they were tremendously sensitive microphones, so that if your stomach rumbled, they would stop the recording and give you a bit of banana to eat to settle the tummy and go on. And I found it quite hard work, but very interesting.
That audio version has, of course, made the book accessible to people who may have a print disability or can't see. Is that important to you?
Yes, I think audiobooks now are a really, really valuable facility for people who have difficulty in reading. My own mum has huge difficulty now with the printed page, and she listens to a lot of audiobooks, and there are many like her.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. Still to come, Nigel Havers, George Dunn, Kate Williams, and now...
Let's take a journey from racially charged Alabama to the Oval Office with Eric Motley. His book, Madison Park, A Place of Hope, is narrated by Brandon Maloney.
The years 1964 to 1972 were turbulent for Barbara Ann. As fate would have it, her struggles coincided with the political and social upheaval rippling across the country. Barbara Ann rode the wave of black students integrating Robert E. Lee High School and, in 1973, was among the first to earn a diploma from the formerly all-white school. She eagerly looked toward her future. But in 1972, when Barbara Ann was 18, she found out she was pregnant. She gave birth in a Tuskegee hospital a week before Christmas, bringing her newborn home to 34 Motley Drive in Madison Park. They called me Eric.
A clip of Brandon Maloney reading from Madison Park by Eric Motley. And Eric joins me now. Eric, tell us about the book.
Well, the book is a story about a place in Montgomery, Alabama, the American South. It is a story about how a group of freed slaves organized themselves, having very little, having not long been emancipated, and how they desired to create a community. And they acquired a plantation, they purchased a plantation, and they created a community, the spirit of a community. And it's really a story about the place, how it came to be, how it was founded by these freed slaves and their aspirations to live into the fullness of the American dream. It's a story about my own personal journey and how my life intersected with the people in that place and how those individuals and their descendants came to have such a meaningful impact and impression on my own development and evolution. And then it's really a love affair, a story about a love for a place and a people and what takes me back and what I've taken with me from that place.
And your journey itself is remarkable as well. Tell us about that.
Well, I left Madison Park. I had some academic challenges early on. People in the small town organized themselves to help me to accelerate and to reclaim my academic status or to reclaim my academic commitment to learning. And then I went off to college, Samford University. Had a great experience there. I got a Rotary Ambassadorial Scholarship to go to the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. I was there, and during the course of that 1 year, I fell in love with the place. My appetite for learning increased, and so I stayed on and did a PhD. And then I left from there and I went to the White House, moved back to America, Washington, D.C., got a job at the White House, worked for President Bush, and was there for about 4.5 years. And then I went to the State Department and worked there for Condoleezza Rice and Dina Powell. And then I left from there, and I went to the Aspen Institute, and that's where I remain, which is a public policy organization in Washington, D.C., nonpartisan. A think tank is a public policy organization. It's where a lot of people who are former secretaries of state, former cabinet officials and foreign ministers and domestic ministers go to work after their years in government to continue to try to find solutions to very complex societal problems. And so we're nonpartisan, neither Democrat, neither Republican, and we work at bringing people together to try to find some common ground and to try to find the best solutions to those complex issues.
Now, you talk about some of the characters in the book, like Aunt Shine and the guy who was stealing gas.
Yeah.
Are any of those people still around? And did any of them witness the end of your journey?
Oh, my gosh. You actually read the book or listened to the book. Wow. Aunt Shine was this muscular woman, muscular in faith and physique. She was strong in character. And she was a person who intervened when I was failing academically. And she designed a plan for me to have what I call resurrection. And she ended up having a very important role in my life. She ended up dying while I was at the White House. So she lived long enough to see me go abroad, get a PhD, come back to the U.S. And, you know, one of my last conversations with her was, if you're satisfied because you have a PhD, if you're satisfied because you now work at the White House, then I'm disappointed in you. Because it's not about having achieved those things. Mm. It's about achieving your own sense of place in society and discovering how you can give back in a way that improves the lives of others, right? So none of this investment that we've made in you is about your professional development. It's about your human development, the human material. Alan Sowery, oh my God, he was the guy who siphoned gas from his car in the darkness of the night.
Oh, it was from his car, right?
Yeah, it was from his car.
He wasn't stealing it.
No. He was siphoning gas from his car to put in my grandfather's car because my grandfather didn't have enough gas once a week to drive me into the city to participate in youth programming at the YMCA. Mm. And my grandfather would have made way. He would have found the resources, but Alan Sowery wanted to do whatever he could to soften the blow.
Yeah.
And so we never knew, I never knew that that actually took place until one day when I bumped into a local community character who was drunk. And he asked me for some money, and I gave him some money. And then he said to me, oh, by the way, did you know the story about how I would always push the car up the driveway, Alan Sowery's car up the driveway, so that it could be parallel to your grandfather's car? And I was a guy who had to siphon gas from Alan Sowery's car to your grandfather's car. And Alan Sowery gave me 50 cents to push it up and 50 cents to push it down. Alan Sowery had long been dead. And so I never had the opportunity of saying thank you to him. He never had the opportunity of actually seeing what that investment, that little investment that he was making, would manifest itself into in my life. And so in many ways, this book is an expression of gratitude to those who are and to those who are no more. I went back to Madison Park about 3 weeks ago to bury and to eulogize a 90-year-old person who was my childhood hero, Dr. Winston. And I went back, and of course I saw all the friends, all the old neighbors, but most are gone.
Yeah. What's the full title of the book, and why did you call it that?
I wanted people to know the name Madison Park. You know, there's a very fancy restaurant in New York called Madison Park, and it's a 5-star restaurant, and it's a place where to get one course, you're paying almost $200, right? And so friends of mine are always saying, have you been to Madison Park? You got to go to Madison Park. And I like to say, there's another Madison Park that's very different from the Madison Park that you're talking about. So I wanted to put the place in people's mind. But the name of the book is Madison Park, A Place of Hope. And it's called A Place of Hope because in 1880, those freed slaves had nothing except dreams and aspirations, faith in one another, and hope. And I believe that what has made Madison Park work and survive is a relentless commitment to hope, a relentless commitment to seeing the promise and to looking on the other side of the challenges that we have, realizing that we all have the ability to create the conditions for something better. And so I believe in hope.
Eric Motley, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robert. Thank you. It was a real honor.
Also at the Boswell Book Festival was Professor
Kate Williams. Best-selling historian, broadcaster, and royal expert, Kate Williams has appeared on shows from The Great British Bake Off to Newsnight, Today, and Restoration Home. Here she is, narrating her book, Young Elizabeth.
The name Elizabeth was chosen because it was her mother's, not to recall Elizabeth I. The princess took her names from her mother, her great-grandmother, and her grandmother, and indeed her initials were identical to those of her mother, E.A.M. She was named after consorts and wives, not ruling queens.
Young Elizabeth, written and read by Kate Williams. I asked Kate what book she was talking about at the Boswell Book Festival.
I was talking about my ninth book, my fifth biography, which is a biography of Mary Queen of Scots and Elizabeth, Rival Queens, The Betrayal of Mary Queen of Scots. It wasn't easy. Mary was surrounded by enemies on all sides. I mean, when you look at both of them, Elizabeth, the men around her did undermine her, but they did it by ignoring her or going behind her back. In Mary, they tried to abduct her, to kidnap her, they stabbed her servant, they imprisoned her, anything that they could do to undermine her. So being a woman with power was impossible in many ways. And the big problem for any woman with power came with a husband, because husbands really, in those days, expected to be king and expected to rule over you. And that often annoyed all the other men around you. So it's almost whatever you do, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. If you get married, you're criticised. If you don't get married, you're criticised. It's not easy. Women and power, I'm really fascinated by. I'm fascinated by the lives of women in the past, and particularly how women negotiated power, because it was a negotiation in every way. For every monarch, the most powerful woman you've got, and still it's a negotiation, even for Elizabeth II. But for Mary, you see how a woman can be undermined in the most brutal manner, imprisoned, attacked, assaulted, and finally executed. So she does lose everything. So most women just about manage to hold on to their power. They negotiate, they have strategies. Mary, she lost it all.
Now, in your work as a historian, what's the perception of sight loss through the ages?
Well, sight is very important through the ages. It's very important to the Tudor period, because you can't really have glasses and you can't really have aids. So sight is absolutely vital. And I do think there are many people whose sight is degenerating, but they won't admit it and they won't talk about it. And it's something actually that I think is sometimes quite hidden in history. But certainly sight is absolutely vital, particularly to a monarch, because they need to read what they're signing, because they can't, if someone reads it to them, they could be lying to them and they could be just putting their signature. Mary, when she was a young girl, signed some blank pieces of paper to please her very power-hungry relations. And in a sense, that's why sight is so important as a monarch, because you can't trust anyone. So if you're signing something, you have to be sure that you're reading it, because of course they didn't have anything as brilliant as Braille in those days. So what they had no choice. I'm so grateful that my books are available for the blind and partially sighted and print disabled. It's so important to me, and I'm so grateful for what everyone does to create them into these editions. I think it's so vital and so important. It's really thrilling to me that people who can't see can read my books. As an author, I want to write books and to share these amazing worlds, but it doesn't seem fair that they could only be shared with people who are sighted.
Have you ever narrated any of your books?
I have narrated one of my books. I narrated Young Elizabeth. But actually, it's harder than I would have thought, because if you're reading someone else's prose, that's fair enough. You're reading your own prose, you think, oh, I might change that sentence. So it's actually I found it quite difficult. But it's a tough job. And I have to say, I was really in awe of those people who do it, and the actors and actresses who get through it in 10 hours and other presenters. It's not easy.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. When the studios moved to a new building in the 1970s, one of the big advantages was the new size of tape.
In those days, we used to record on 1-inch tape, directly onto 1-inch tape, and that 1-inch tape was sent to the production unit in Alberton, where they made the cassettes. But then we moved to just up the road from Great Portland Street, the original studios, and we moved about 50 yards up the road to new studios, and we recorded on 1/4-inch tape. Now, the difference it made meant that for the first time ever, we were able to have a copy, or a master rather, a master copy of every single book we did. Prior to that, the 1-inch tape was the only recording we had of any book, and we were very lucky not to lose any of our recordings.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service. offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Boswell Book Festival has had lots of military guests, including Victor Gregg with his book Rifleman, and bomber pilot George Dunn.
We were all young. We were, I suppose, a lot different to an 18, 20-year-old of today. There was no such things as tablets or smartphones or anything like that. So we were quite happy to, well, I was anyway, to have the opportunity of joining up, because when you think about it, at the end of the day, I was able to fly two of the finest aircraft in the Air Force, which was the Mosquito and the Spitfire, and got paid for doing it.
How long did the training take?
Well, I started flying in January 42 in Canada, finished in September. That was EFTS and service flying training. That was two courses. Came back to this country in September 42, went to, got back to this country, did a short course on airspeed Oxfords to get used to English conditions, because of course we had blackout here, whereas Canada was all lit up. From there on to OTU on Wellington's. From OTU on Wellington's down to New York on Halifax's, and then on to a squadron. So if you say from January 42 to April 43, that will be the time factor. So that's what, 15 months, yeah.
Doesn't sound very long.
You couldn't avoid the time gap, really, because don't forget you had to travel to Canada, you had to come back, and then there was a period of in a hotel at Bournemouth before going on the first course. So there's a certain amount of that time which was, you might call, dead time.
Mm. What missions really stand out to you? What ones do you really remember?
Well, of course, the main one was Peenemünde. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Peenemünde was the where the V weapons were produced, and when it was first notified to the intelligence services in 1940, but they didn't take any notice. They thought it was a ruse to divert the intelligence services for no good reason. So as the years went on. This was 1940, and don't forget the first V1 V2 rocket was not fired until September 44, because they had a lot of setbacks with the production of the V weapons, particularly the Doodlebug, which was a forerunner of the V weapon. But had that not taken place, the Peenemünde raid, we might well have been in trouble in this country, because at that time they were producing what they called the V3, which was a gun, a huge gun, which would have fired, if it had been produced, would have fired 60 rockets a minute on London. And you can imagine the... So Peenemünde, without doubt, was the most important raid that I took part in.
Was it heavily defended?
No, it wasn't.
Quite unusual.
You see, it was too near Berlin. And they didn't... You see, there have been lots of reconnaissance flights over Peenemünde, but they never fired on the aircraft because they didn't want the authorities to know that there was anything going on. Mm. If they'd fired on the reconnaissance aircraft, it would have given the game away.
When was the last time you flew?
When I came out the RAF in 1947. I brought a Halifax back from Egypt and delivered it to Fairford in Gloucester, and that was it.
Right. Never had the desire to get back in the cockpit?
No, I did win in a raffle a half an hour's instructional flight on at Goodwood when he let me take over.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading if we can just create the talking books. You know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival. Now, the Curtain Up event at this year's festival featured an evening with Nigel Havers, who was there to talk about his autobiography, Playing With Fire. The unabridged RNIB talking book version is read by Charles Armstrong.
By the time we came to shoot what would be the opening scene in Chariots of Fire, I had been inhabiting the skin of Lord Alfred Lindsay for several months. So, when Hugh Hudson, the director, asked if I felt able to age up in order to play my character as a man well into his 80s, I had little hesitation. The scene was a memorial service for the sprinter Harold Abrahams and took place in a London church. I had to spend 6 hours in makeup. As the face in the mirror got steadily older, I started remembering my grandfather, the way he walked, the way he talked and held his head. And as the finishing touches were at last applied, I suddenly remembered that Dad's chambers were just round the corner, so rang and invited him to come to the set and watch some of the morning's filming. When he arrived, he walked straight past me and professed not to recognise me at all until he heard my voice. I'm not sure if his reaction was genuine or whether he was doing it to give me pleasure. Either way, it was rather charming. My father was quite a guy. He had two passions, the law and living, the first providing the second. Law runs through the Havers family like blood runs through veins. My grandfather was Sir Cecil Havers, a notable High Court judge who was famous for, among other things, sentencing Ruth Ellis, the last woman to be executed in this country. My aunt is Dame Elizabeth Butler Sloss, also a High Court judge, and until recently head of the family justice system. My brother Philip is an eminent human rights barrister, and my niece Holly has recently joined one of London's largest firms of solicitors. Then there's me. Actually, I think every successful barrister has to have something of the actor in him, and Dad didn't just have a little something, he had it in spades. In 1981, as Attorney General, he was obliged to be chief prosecutor in the trial of Peter Sutcliffe, the notorious Yorkshire Ripper. On the day Dad started his case for the prosecution, I slipped into the viewing gallery. He had rung the week before to ask whether I wanted to come and see something special. "Is that the new play at the National?" I asked. "No, he replied. I thought you might like to come and see me for a change. Peter Sutcliffe was surprisingly small, with wild black curly hair and very black eyes. The sort of eyes that have swallowed up the horror they have witnessed, and sacrificed all life and expression in the process, leaving dark holes the colour of deadly nightshade in their place. When the judge gestured for proceedings to begin, my father got slowly to his feet. He stood, motionless, looking down at his notes. Silence. He stayed like that for several minutes, the tension building to breaking point. Just as the judge was about to intervene, he looked up, straight into Sutcliffe's eyes. Another silence. "Could you confirm how you spell your name?" he said. "One T and two Fs. Is that right?" Sutcliffe just nodded. Dad turned. There was a flurry of activity from the junior counsel huddled behind him. Everyone in the courtroom seemed to be holding their breath. Another long silence. I think the judge thought Dad had lost the plot. Eventually, Dad turned and fixed Sutcliffe with a hawk-like stare. "At least we've got that right," he said. "Tell me, did you enjoy killing those women?" The air suddenly seemed to have been sucked out of the room. It became difficult to breathe, and people started to lick their lips. I looked down and saw goosebumps on my arms. It felt as if the air conditioning had suddenly been cranked up to maximum.
So begins Playing with Fire by Nigel Havers. At the Boswell Book Festival, he told me about the book.
Well, the book is about me. you know, I spent 3 months writing this book. 9 to 5, like I was sort of going to an office, I did it. And I was sort of rather dreading doing it to begin with, but I really enjoyed doing it in the end. And I didn't have too much interference, and there you are. It was a fun experience.
And you read the abridged version?
I loved that. I've done sort of radio and commercial voiceovers for years, so I love just talking into a microphone. I find that kind of rather restful.
Life was hell. The lack of food and sleep were beginning to turn me stark, staring bonkers. Added to which, looking back, I think I truly began to believe that I was William Wills. For the one and only time in my life, a part began to inhabit my being, and I started behaving very oddly. One day, as I was putting on my filthy old costume and having the makeup done, I noticed that the shot required us to be practically crawling on the ground. It was to be filmed by a sodding great long lens, and Graham and the crew were sitting miles away, waiting for us to get into position. "I'm not going anywhere until that director comes over to say good morning," I said. Shock registered on the face of the third assistant, this normally mild-mannered and quite cheerful actor throwing a hissy fit, or spitting the dummy, as they call it over there. He quickly walked over to Graham. "Nigel says he's not doing anything until you come and say good morning." Pause. "Has he lost his mind?" "Well, I think he means it." I screwed up my eyes and watched Graham, dressed in his habitual white linen, walk the 100 yards or so to where I was standing. "Good morning," he said, and he turned on his heel and walked back. The outback can do strange things to a person. One scene took place in a dust storm, and we had to have aeroplane propellers chucking dust in our faces for 3 whole days, unimaginably foul for us. Piece of cake for Simon and the rest of the camels. Those guys can survive anything. We also had to contend with the flies. I know everyone talks about those Aussie flies, but until you experience them at first hand, you can have no idea how hellish they make your life. I wore a hat with a net whenever I wasn't actually on camera, but on one close-up a fly actually walked across my eye, right across the middle. I'm quite proud of the fact that I didn't flinch, but the secret fact is that because I wear contact lenses, I was just about able to bear it. Another time we were filming on some salt flats. You could see at least 100 miles in every direction, everything dancing in that torrid heat. The crew were about 1/2 mile away, filming with the longest lens in existence. There is only one of those lenses in the entire world because it is so expensive to produce. Directors have to put themselves on a list and queue to use it, all of which adds to the pressures of filming, as there is absolutely no margin for error. Jack and I were acting up a storm, half crazed with thirst and exhaustion. One of us glanced over at the crew and found that they had broken for lunch and forgotten to send the runner to tell us. "I'll kill them," I yelled. Jack was able to find this quite amusing, but madman that I had become, I sulked for days.
Now, one chapter of the book stands out, your filming experience in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because the character I played in that movie, Birkenwood, was such an extreme, you know, to die in the middle of nowhere, and it got under my skin a bit. But it was a good experience and an amazing story.
Especially when you got back to civilization and you couldn't leave the hotel room.
I couldn't, no. I hadn't, see, we lived, you know, 800 miles from the nearest telephone or town. And after two months or so, you forget about things like traffic and noise and stuff. Mm. So when I came back to the big city, I got sort of agoraphobia. I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave the room. I couldn't cross the road. I tried to once, I just went straight back.
We eventually arrived in Adelaide, where we had a few days off before some more shooting just outside the city. It was terrifying. Suddenly, I found myself on my own in the middle of an enormous city, and I couldn't deal with the culture shock. By the time I got to my hotel room, I was a bundle of nerves, and I didn't leave the room for 2 days. I rang home to speak to Caro and give my love to Kate before I passed out. I just slept, ate room service food, and generally got my head together. The rest of the cast were doing exactly the same thing. We were all completely drained and exhausted.
Is it important that there's an accessible version of your book?
I actually have a sight problem myself, in fact. The retinal membrane at the back of my right eye is becoming unattached, so I have problems with my right eye, so I can, you know, understand how difficult it is to be blind, and I'm very aware of, you know, doing as much as I can to help.
Is that something that you're aware of on stage, like you have to be extra careful where your mark is and things like that?
I do now, yeah. I have to work much harder. It's putting a key into a keyhole is more difficult.
I realised I was grinning like an idiot. There was a light at the end of the tunnel. I knew things were never going to be easy, but there was just a chance that, together, we could get life back on track. With post-production schedules in Sydney, we weren't due back in London for a couple of months. Whatever the future held, I'd be able to take a break from playing with fire.
Nigel Havers, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Pleasure. Thank you very much for asking.
And that's it for today's show. Remember to tune in at the same time next week for more book news, reviews and author interviews. And if you want to catch up with our previous shows, just type RNIB Read On into your favourite search engine. I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. And remember to join me every day of the week on RNIB Connect Radio for our sister show Talking Books. The full schedule can be found at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.